Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today's Wednesday. It's the 6th of July. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard, and it'll just be you and I. Today, we're going to be covering a lot of international news, and so much is going on. I guess the most important is about water scarcity. It seems that European Union countries are forced to restrict drinking water access. That's mind-boggling. Severe droughts and scarce rain have forced water restrictions in southern European countries. Climate change is making itself felt across the continent. Well, amplified by human-induced climate change and water overconsumption, southern Europeans are feeling the consequences of more extreme heat waves and longer droughts. Now governments from Portugal to Italy are calling on citizens to limit water use to the bare minimum, but in some places, this is not enough. So while private consumption of water in the European Union accounts for just 9% of total usage, around 60% is absorbed by agriculture. So droughts are one thing, said Nihat Zal, a water expert at the European Environmental Agency, the EEA, which informs European Union environment policy. The other is how much water we take out of the system. Well, in Italy, the situation is probably most dramatic in northern Italy, where the region is suffering the worst drought in 70 years. More than 100 cities have called on to limit water consumption as much as possible. On Monday, the Italian government declared a state of emergency for 5 regions until the end of the year. It plans to provide $37 million in the short term to combat the water crisis, actually. So due to months of drought and scarce winter rain, the water levels of the Dora, Baltea, and Po, these are the rivers, the longest river in Italy, are 8 times lower than usual. Both rivers feed one of the most important agricultural regions in all of Europe, with 30% of production currently threatened by drought. Well, the irrigation authority in the northwestern region around the Sestia River has already ordered that fruit trees and poplars no longer be watered. The saved water will be used to irrigate the economically important rice crop. Well, the mayors of the city of Verona has announced that watering gardens and sports fields, washing cars and patios, and filling pools and swimming pools is now prohibited until the end of August to safeguard drinking water supplies. Vegetable gardens may only be watered at night. Pisa is also resorting to rationing. As of this month, drinking water can only be used, quote, for domestic use, and personal hygiene and failure to comply will result in fines of up to 500 euros. That's $516. In Milan, meanwhile, all decorative water fountains have been turned off. The mayor of the small town of Castenazzo wants to tackle the problem unconventionally. He's banned hairdressers and barbers from washing their customers' hair twice. There are 10 hairdressers in the small town of 16,000 inhabitants with a measure aiming to save thousands of liters of water per day. Now let's move on to Portugal. Portugal started to prepare for an extremely dry year back in winter. At the start of 2022, a lack of rainfall and low water levels in dams prompted the government to restrict the use of hydroelectric power plants to 2 hours per week. The goal is to guarantee the drinking water supply for Portugal's 10 million inhabitants for at least 2 years. What became apparent during the winter is that all the more evident and is all the more evident today. By the end of May, severe drought already prevailed in 97% of the country. And due to the burning of coal, oil, and gas, droughts that normally occur only once every 10 years have already become almost twice as likely in the Mediterranean region. And some regions are experiencing the worst dry season in 1,000 years. The Association for Agricultural Irrigation in the town of Silves, Lagoa, and Portimão in southern Portugal has already activated an emergency plan under which 1,800 farms have to have HALVE, the irrigation of some crops. Well, Portugal's avocado boom is a harmful harvest, evidently. Duarte Cordeiro, the Portuguese Minister of Environment and Climate Action, stated last week that despite current preparations, the country will have to live with restrictions and higher water costs in the future. Duarte urged the business community to invest in water-saving measures, with Nihatzal of the EEA seeing diverse opportunities to increase efficiency and reduce water wastage. On average, 25% of fresh water is lost on the way to the water source, such as a river, to an industrial area, Zal had noted. Making water infrastructure more efficient will bring huge potential savings. So Spain is also extremely dry, with two-thirds of the total land area at risk of desertification, and once fertile soils are increasingly turning to sand, especially after the second driest winter since 1961, according to Spain's Meteorological Bureau. So in the north, 17 localities were forced to take drastic measures as early as February, with the town of Campelles in Catalonia limiting running water to a few hours per day. For emergencies, the municipality deposited water buckets filled daily at five locations in the village. In the small town of Vacarisses in the province of Barcelona, wells and groundwater pipes are also dry. Currently, people only have running water between 6 and 10 in the morning and from 8 in the evening until midnight. Spain is the third largest producer of agricultural products in the European Union. At least 70% of all fresh water is used for agriculture. The demand doesn't stop growing, said Juan Berrea of Greenpeace Spain. Posing policies that save water, we are acting as if Spain had as much water as Norway or Finland. In reality, we are more than on the level of North Africa. Although efficient drip irrigation is already used on a large proportion of agricultural land, at least one-fifth is still irrigated using unsustainable methods. To better manage the water crisis, it is necessary to move from crisis management and water rationing to instead think of the long-term, said Zal of the EEA. So this means more efficiency in the use of water, forward-looking risk management, and preparation for the next crisis. It also means, quote, adapting to climate change at the individual level, at the local level, at the government level, at all levels. So this is what is very, very important. So, one second. All right, so let's just look at some other things that are really interesting. Let's look at something else which is happening in Europe, which you may find interesting. In Germany, a record number of people are leaving churches. Hundreds of thousands of people have resigned their membership in Germany's Protestant and Catholic churches. 15 years ago, 61% of Germans belonged to churches, a number that has now dropped below 50%. Last year was a record year for Germany in that, for the first time, less than half of the country belonged to a church. The Catholic Church saw hundreds of thousands of members officially resign their membership, and large numbers of former Protestants followed suit. According to newly published documents from the German Bishops' Conference, the DVK, at least 359,000 Catholics left the church in 2021, a huge leap from the 221,390 who left in 2020. Even in deeply Catholic Bavaria, 14,035 people left the church from January to June of this year in Munich alone, almost double the number for the same time period in 2019. Also, in 2021, some 228,000 Protestants left to 20 different denominations registered in Germany. In 2020, that number was 60,000. Most Catholics do not attend Mass. DVK Chairman Georg Betzing said he was, quote, deeply shocked by the extremely high number of people leaving the church, end quote. It is testimony to a, quote, profound crisis in which we find ourselves at the Catholic, as a Catholic church in Germany, he added. Even among those who still belong to the church, extremely few regularly attend Mass, according to the DVK. Only 4.3% of Catholics said they go to church most Sundays. And to these numbers, we must add the realization that, quote, not only are the people leaving those who have had little or even no contact with their parish for a long period of time, but there is increasing feedback that people are taking the step who were previously very committed to their church, as Beijing had said. There is no longer anything we can take for granted as the Catholic Church. We have to explain ourselves anew, explain what we do and why we do it. It remains to be seen to what extent shifting cultural norms, child abuse, and the COVID-19 pandemic have to do with declining church membership and attendance. There's also the matter of church taxes, which some have written on social media is too great an expense in a time of soaring inflation and uncertain economic future. Church taxes are common practice in several European countries, whereby members of religious communities pay a tax, an 8 or 9% additional levy in Germany, depending on the state, in order to finance its operations. Now, although it is called the church tax, it does not apply only to Christian communities in Germany. Whatever the cause, the change in German society is clear. 15 years ago, 61% of Germans belonged to either a Catholic or a Protestant church. 26% of Germans are officially registered as Catholics, and 23.7% as Protestants. Very troubling. So I'm sure that in so many other religious denominations, we have similar issues. Frightening. Really is frightening when you come to think about all these changes. 1 second. Yeah, I think you'll find this interesting in our hemisphere, in Guatemala. Now, this is not going to be for us, sorry. 1 second. All right. Well, this is really very interesting. The question is, why does Pakistan fear another COVID wave? Seems that health experts are warning of a new surge ahead of Eid al-Adha celebrations. They say the holiday could fuel a new coronavirus wave as cases in Pakistan are already on the rise. Experts have warned that another surge in coronavirus cases in Pakistan could overburden the country's already fragile health care system. They expect the wave to be coincident with the Muslim festival of Eid al-Adha, which takes place this weekend. Well, the country's National Command and Operations Center, the NCOC, which aims to manage the virus, on Tuesday issued a new set of guidelines amid fears of a new rise in cases, requesting that people use face masks and practice social distancing. Eid prayers will be organized in open spaces under stringent COVID protocols, the NCOC said. So according to the data released by the National Institute of Health Islamabad, NIH, in Pakistan on Monday, recorded 675 new cases with a rate of positive cases from people tested of 4.61%, marking a substantial increase from the past month. So just a month ago, the positive percentage of tests was just 0.454%, with only 79 cases and no deaths. So according to official data, Pakistan has recorded over 1.5 million confirmed cases and more than 30,400 deaths since the start of the pandemic. So officials are calling for holiday caution. According to the NIH, 85% of the eligible population have been fully vaccinated against the virus. Federal Health Minister Abdul Hadir Patel, meanwhile, urged people to remain at home during the Eid holidays to curb the spread of the virus. Be careful during upcoming Eid holidays. Follow standard operating procedures and save yourself, your friends and family from sickness. Prevent what you can and let the state worry about other health issues, President Arif Alvi had written on Twitter. So the quick transmission is indicating that we have just entered into the sixth wave of this deadly virus. Dr. Hazair Sayyad, the Secretary General of the Pakistan Medical Association, advised. Primary concern is that the asymptomatic people are the dangerous carriers and transmitters, he added. However, the government believes that the situation is under control and there is no need to enforce a lockdown in the country, Federal Health Minister Patel had said. Health experts say that there is a lack of awareness of the virus and that people are not taking the situation seriously as millions of people prepare to attend the community prayers at mosques this weekend. Well, there is a disregard for precautionary measures, not just in Pakistan, all over the world. There is huge mistrust between the government and the public on the communication of messages and people not responding to authoritarian messages. Dr. Fahia Irfan, a public health physician and expert in health policy and management, advised. So masks were dropped as early as June and July of 2020 in public offices. Meetings shown on TV without masks prompted people to ignore the precautions, Irfan had added. The rapid increase in cases in Karachi, the capital, over the last weeks has also alarmed experts and spurred officials to rethink their lockdown strategy. Positive test rate in Karachi is currently at 21%, with 456 new cases reported on Monday. Pakistan's Aviation Regulatory Authority recently made masks compulsory during domestic flights in the wake of the recent surge in Karachi. There is an urgent need to take precautionary measures and avoid gatherings on this Eid. The testing ratio is quite low, and I fear that the positive rate in Karachi is factually around 35%, which could throw the country into a new health crisis, warned Sayyad. In this new wave, there is a trajectory towards a doubling of cases. It's a strong possibility that we will see an alarming situation and rise in cases if people do not stop being careless, said Irfan. So these are all troubling moments. So much that's going on in the world stage, it's really a little bit frightening. One second. One second here. More trouble in China. More mass COVID testing in Beijing, Shanghai, and Macau. Teams of residents throughout China are facing a new wave of COVID-19 cases. New measures to stop the spread dash hopes that Beijing will end its strict zero COVID policy. China dealing with a new wave of COVID-19 cases. Residents of Shanghai, Beijing, and Xi'an were ordered to undergo rounds of testing in a bid to trace sources of the new cases. Tightened restrictions have also been placed on businesses and residents, Macau and Hong Kong. and the official response to the outbreak is sparking fresh fears of lockdowns in line with China's zero COVID policy that has begun to face criticism as being untenable. Well, people now aren't really scared of COVID anymore. They're scared of being locked down in their homes, said a Shanghai resident who gave his name as Yao in an interview with Agence France Presse. Shanghai closed all karaoke bars on Wednesday after an emerging cluster of cases were linked to an illegal karaoke lounge in the city. China's most populous city recently emerged from lockdowns in April and May. Shanghai city officials are now under mounting pressure to contain the new potential spread. There should be no slacking, said the Shanghai health official Zhao Dandan at a briefing. Several Chinese areas facing local outbreaks and infections have emerged as a community level in Shanghai, to which we should attach great importance. Shanghai tested all residents in half of its 16 districts on Tuesday to Thursday, tests in parts of three other districts, and the city reported 24 new cases on Tuesday and 8 the previous day. Well, there are new cases in Beijing and Xi'an. The city of Beijing has been conducting regular rounds of testing after a recent spate of outbreaks emerged linked to a nightclub spot. A steel fence has been installed around at least one residential compound in Shunyi to prevent residents from leaving. The suburb that lies outside of Beijing center is home to many foreign residents and diplomats. Well, authorities on Tuesday also reported that more than 300 new cases in Xi'an, a city that lies more than 620 miles southwest of Beijing, the city of around 13 million, was placed under temporary control measures after 29 new cases were discovered on Saturday, primarily among recycling workers. Xi'an also endured a month-long full-scale shutdown at the end of the year. Then go on to Macau. Macau's casino industry suffers. Seems like more than 14,000 people are also in quarantine in Macau. Authorities reported 146 new infections in the gambling hub, bringing Macau's cases to more than 1,000 since mid-June. This marks the special administrative region's largest outbreak since the onset of the global pandemic. Authorities have ordered closures to most establishments apart from casinos to contain the spread, and residents are obliged to participate in a testing drive. More than 80% of tax revenue in Macau comes from the casino industry. Some casinos have been allowed to stay open to ensure job security. However, the Grand Lisboa, one of the city's best-known landmarks, became the second casino to be shuttered on Tuesday after more than a dozen of cases were discovered there. So, owners, owners of the Grand Lisboa said that the company stands united with the entire community in this health crisis and wishes Macau a rapid recovery from the pandemic in an email statement to Reuters. Casinos that remain open are staffed with fewer workers and receive smaller numbers of patrons. Revenues from the industry are likely to be zero for at least several weeks, analysts said. A return to zero COVID? Well, cases in neighboring Hong Kong have also been on the rise since late June, reported infections averaged around 2,000 per day for the month so far. Shanghai, Beijing, and Macau all adhere to China's zero COVID policy, which involves limited movement, targeted lockdowns, and mass testing. Hong Kong imposed the same policy during earlier breakdowns. The city is assessing whether to shorten COVID-19 quarantines for travelers, said John Lee, Hong Kong's new chief executive, and whether this would make it possible to keep infection numbers in check. However, the leader also said on Wednesday that Hong Kong must not lie flat, quote unquote, when it comes to containing the virus. So we'll just have to see where all that goes. Bear with me a moment. Need to get some fluid in the body. That was good. Good old seltzer water, which I like very much. No sugar at all, so that's important. And 1 second here. Okay. Let's see if this is going to inform us to some extent or another. European Parliament is backing listing nuclear energy and gas as green. Seems a proposal to label natural gas and nuclear energy as green as a guide for private investors was met with resistance along the way, but European Union lawmakers ultimately gave it the green light. I wonder if that's going to happen here. Well, the European Parliament on Wednesday voted in favor of a proposal regarding labeling natural gas and nuclear power plants as climate-friendly investments. The European Commission released a proposal formally called the European Union Taxonomy in December as a list of economic activities that investors can label and market as green in the European Union. So a motion to block the proposal received 278 votes in favor and 328 votes against, while 33 lawmakers, European Union's 27 member states, opposed the proposal. It will be passed into law. The proposal was initially met with resistance among some European Union states, with one camp led by France strongly backing the green label for natural gas and nuclear energy. Meanwhile, Germany, which has been phasing out its nuclear power plants, had opposed the plan. So some environmental groups and European Union lawmakers have also criticized the plan for greenwashing fossil fuels and nuclear energy. So Austria and Luxembourg have even threatened to sue the European Union if the plan becomes law. Still, the proposal had the backing of the majority of the center-right European People's Party, European Parliament's largest lawmaker group, lawmakers of the centrist Renew Europe group, were largely in favor of the proposal, while the Greens and Social Democrats mostly opposed it. A total of 353 lawmakers, a majority of the Parliament's 705 lawmakers, are needed to reject a plan for it to fail. So a sharp reduction in Russian gas supplies to Europe in recent weeks has triggered more opposition to the European Union taxonomy's classification of gas as green. It's dirty politics and it's an outrageous outcome to label gas and nuclear as green and keep more money flowing to Russian President Vladimir Putin's war chest. Greenpeace European Union Sustainable Finance campaigner Ariadna Rodrigo said, "We will fight this in the courts," she added. Paul Tang, a Dutch European Union lawmaker with a center-left social democrat, had criticized the plan as influenced by, quote, the lobby from Gazprom and Rosneft, both Russian state-owned energy companies. Tang also slammed the move as institutionalizing greenwashing, end quote. It is now important to prevent this vote from setting a precedent for other countries to temper climate ambitions, he wrote in a statement. Christoph Hansen, a conservative European Union parliamentarian from Luxembourg, said that Wednesday's result will make the taxonomy obsolete. quote, we are sacrificing the future to the present by including gas and nuclear in the taxonomy. And this short-sightedness undermines the credibility and durability of the taxonomy as a long-term compass for investors, Hansen wrote on Twitter. So Bogdan Rzonka, a Polish member of the European Parliament and MEP for the right-wing Law and Order, Law and Justice Party, the PIS, said less wealthy European Union countries need private investments in gas and nuclear power to be able to move away from the coal. Gilles Boyer, a French minister of the European Parliament with the Renew Group, said that meeting energy demand with renewable energy in the long term would be ideal, but is not possible right now. Well, Czech Prime Minister Petr Fiala, whose country has just taken over the rotating European Union presidency, said on Wednesday's vote was excellent news for Europe. It paves the way towards energy self-sufficiency, which is absolutely crucial for our future, he wrote on Twitter. So where does Germany stand on the taxonomy? On the taxonomy, Germany initially objected to the European Commission's proposal to label nuclear energy as green. Yet on Wednesday, Stefan Haberstreit, a spokesman for German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, said that Berlin, quote, stands by its position and considers nuclear energy as unsustainable. Nevertheless, the German government believes that the taxonomy is an important instrument for achieving climate protection targets because it is clear that natural gas is an important bridging technology for us on the way to carbon dioxide neutrality and the conclusion, or the inclusion rather, of the use of natural gas in the delegated act, which takes this into account, Haberstreit had added. So these are some of the issues that are taking place there. Now, let's look at some other issues which you may find interesting with me a moment. One second here. All right, this is very interesting news. It seems the United States is weighing on restructuring the Trump-era China tariffs to fight inflation. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration remains divided on whether to allow some of the tariffs to expire to ease inflation or renew them to maintain leverage over Beijing. So the U.S. President Joe Biden's administration is looking at whether to cut tariffs on some Chinese imports in a bid to ease inflation, the White House said on Tuesday. So 4 years ago, former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed his first wave of tariffs, which in total would end up covering some $350 billion worth of Chinese imports to the United States. The administration's review is required to keep the duties from automatically expiring. The one deadline for submitting requests is to keep $10 billion in tariffs in place, expires on Wednesday, while another tranche is set to expire on August 22nd. So more than 400 requests to maintain the tariffs on Chinese goods has been submitted to the U.S. Trade Representative's office as of late Tuesday, which complicates any plan on removing them. Such requests can trigger a review and continuation of the tariffs. The deliberation comes as the U.S. Trade Representative's office, the USTR, is conducting a four-year review of the tariffs. Among the associations lobbying for the tariffs to be maintained are 24 labor unions. Labor unions are a key constituency for Biden. So White House, or is it White House Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said that Biden's team was still weighing various strategies and that no decision has yet been made. There is a lot of different elements to this, especially since the previous administration imposed these tariffs in such a haphazard, non-strategic way, Jean-Pierre had said. We want to make sure that we have the right approach, she said. So we'll see what else happens here. So this is going to be coming about very, very shortly. It won't take that much longer until we get an answer on which way the government's going to go. Well, meanwhile, U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai said she's reluctant to give up the leverage provided by the duties. However, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has contended that some of the tariffs serve no strategic purpose. One second. So Yellen has also argued that reconfiguring tariffs could somewhat ease inflation, which has reached a 40% year high. The tariffs are aimed at industrial production such as microchips and chemicals, as well as consumer merchandise. Trump proposed tariffs on imports from China, claiming retaliation for Beijing's alleged theft of American intellectual property and forced transfer of technology. The talks between the United States and China seems that the tariffs were discussed by Secretary Yellen and Chinese Vice Premier Liu He in a call on Monday night. Yellen also raised the issue of what she called Beijing's unfair trade practices in the call with He, according to the U.S. Treasury. And China's commerce industry, or ministry rather, said that Beijing expressed its concern over issues such as the removal of additional tariffs and sanctions imposed by the United States on China and fair treatment of Chinese companies. Well, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is set to meet with Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi at the G20 conference this week in Bali in Indonesia, with trade likely high on the agenda. So we'll have to see where that goes. It's like a continuing effort one way or the other to see which way the government's going to go. Now, let's look at some other issues here. Bear with me a moment. One second. Okay, bear with me a second. Okay. A moment. Okay. All right, so bear with me a moment as we move in to some other issues. Bear with me a second here. Look at what's happening in the UK, because evidently the United Kingdom's Prime Minister Johnson says he's no to quitting amid intensifying call for him to go. Boris Johnson Wednesday pledged to fight on against a snowballing pressure to resign as British Prime Minister, but his defiance was met with yet more ministerial resignation and derision from a growing number of his own Conservative Prime Ministers. So we're going to have to see where all that goes. Johnson says no to a Labour call for a snap election. Johnson rejected demands by the Labour opposition for a snap election. I really don't think that anybody in this country wants politicians to be engaged in electioneering now, he told the Committee of Ministers of Parliament. And I think that we need to get on with serving our voters and dealing with the issues that they care about. Well, earlier in the afternoon, five more junior ministers quit the government en masse. Five more junior ministers, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government en masse on Wednesday, taking the total number to 27 of Tory ministers of parliament who have resigned since Tuesday evening. Quote, in good faith, we must ask that for the good of the party and the country, you step aside, the quintet said in their letter to him, as the chorus of calls grows from within the ruling conservatives for Johnson to resign. And only 5 minutes earlier, Johnson said no, no, no to resignation, arriving at the Palace of Minister of the Palace of Westminster for a scheduled appearance before a parliamentary committee. The Prime Minister responded to a question about whether he will resign by saying no, 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 apparently attempting to echo Margaret Thatcher's famous response to the idea of a European superstate in the House of Commons in 1990. Earlier than that, the key minister Gove was or had told Johnson to go, the Daily Mail reporter had said. Michael Gove, one of the most senior ministers of the British government, had told Johnson that he must quit, the deputy political editor of the Daily Mail had reported. The report said that Gove had told Johnson on Wednesday morning that he needed to stand down. Gove torpedoed Johnson's leadership bid in 2016 before he agreed to work in his government when Johnson became prime minister in 2019. But Gove is the only member of Johnson's cabinet who was part of a Tory cabinet that took power in 2010 under then Prime Minister David Cameron in coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And Gove is widely seen as particularly effective at getting things done, even if he is unpopular among certain sections of the electorate. Well, six further junior ministers had resigned, even sooner than we had mentioned before. Six further junior ministers, Kemi Badenoch, Neil O'Brien, Alex Burghardt, Lee Rowley, Julia Lopez, and Mims Davies, resigned from Johnson's government on Wednesday. So, this is literally unbelievable. So we'll have to find out exactly where this is all going to be going, but it doesn't look like the prime minister is going to go easily. I think at the end, though, he'll get pushed out. It just doesn't seem likely that he'll be able to hang around. So we'll see where that goes. So question now becomes, who could succeed Boris Johnson in Downing Street? Since Boris Johnson's days as United Kingdom's prime minister look numbered after a series of ministerial resignations, but while several possible successors have been suggested, there is no clear favorite. Rishi Sunak, the name comes up very quickly, United Kingdom's first Hindu chancellor of the Exchequer, who quit on Tuesday, was until recently the bookmaker's favorite. But his prospects were dented by questions over his private wealth and family's tax arrangements. His resignation has seen him return as one of the bookies' frontrunners for the top job. Sunak was 42, has a high profile on social media, and won plaudits for shoring up the economy during the pandemic, but his refusal initially to authorize more support over a surge cost of living crisis has hurt his popularity. Then we've got Jeremy Hunt. Former Foreign and Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt is 55, lost to Johnson in the 2019 leadership contest when he branded himself as the serious quote-unquote alternative. Well, Hunt sent a thinly veiled campaign message for a new leadership bid last month. arguing that under Johnson, quote, we are no longer trusted by the electorate and we are set to lose the next general election. That's a quote. But the fluent Japanese speaker lacks Johnson's charisma. His pre-pandemic record as health secretary was recently savaged by Johnson's ally, or by an ally. And then we have Liz Truss. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss is 46, popular among Conservative Party members, liked for her outspokenness and willingness to go on the political attack. That has also stoked questions about her judgment, for instance, when in February she encouraged Britons to fight in Ukraine, and critics say her leadership posturing is too overt. When she headed the Department on International Trade, some ministers of parliament dubbed it the Department of Instagramming Trust because of her prolific output on the social media site. Then you have Sajid Javid. Javid, who also quit as health secretary on Tuesday, had previously resigned as finance minister in 2020. The 52-year-old is the son of a Pakistani immigrant bus driver who went on to become a high-flying banker. Like Sunak, he also faces questions about his personal wealth and tax affairs. Then you got another one of similar age, the defense secretary of 52 years old by the name of Ben Wallace, who has narrowly topped some recent polls of Tory grassroots preferred next leader due to the roles in the Ukraine crisis. The former army officer and Johnson ally has downplayed wanting to lead the party, but is seen as a straight-talking and competent individual. Then we have Nadine Zahawi. Newly appointed as the finance minister, Zahawi, who's 56, was praised for overseeing Britain's pandemic vaccine rollout. Before that, he was education secretary. Zahawi is a former refugee from Iraq who came to Britain as a child speaking no English. Before entering politics, he co-founded the prominent polling company YouGov, Y-O-U-G-O-V. But his private wealth has also drawn adverse attention, including when he claimed parliamentary expenses for heating its horse stables. Then you got Tom Tugendhat, former army officer who's 49, is a prominent backbencher who chairs Parliament's influential Foreign Affairs Committee. And Tugendhat has indicated he will stand in any leadership contest, but there is no love lost between him and Johnson's loyalists. A hawk on China, he has been critical of the government's handling of the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. Then you've got Penny Mordaunt. Mordaunt, who's 49, is the first woman to have been UK Defence Secretary and is currently a junior trade minister. A strong Brexit supporter and key figure in the 2016 Leave campaign, she has been tipped as a potential unity candidate who could draw support from the Conservative Party's warring factions. And then you have Dominic Raab. He's a Deputy Prime Minister and Justice Secretary. Dominic Raab, who is 48, led the country when Johnson was in intensive care in hospital with COVID-19 in 2020. A former lawyer and a karate black belt is seen as a reliable ally. But his move to justice from the post of foreign secretary was seen as a demotion after he initially failed to cut short a holiday in the Afghan capital of Kabul when it fell to the Taliban. So there, that seems to be the issue over there. So I think that's all the time we have together today. All right. So I think that's where we're going to be. We'll speak to you tomorrow when there may be more news, that's for sure. And we'll see where it goes. And I guess that's about it. So this is very interesting. I just found that this at the moment, the new Israeli prime minister by the name of Lapid has urged Macron to visit Iran, to revisit the Iran deal proposal on his Paris trip. So Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid on Tuesday urged French Prime Minister, or French President rather, Emmanuel Macron, to revisit a 2018 proposal for a new Iran deal, saying that the current diplomatic stalemate threatened a Mideast arms race. So to see, this is a video, so I could play that for you.
The number of people among the many crises affecting Israel's interests, as well as French-European security interests, is the Iranian nuclear program. I would like to bring negotiations to a successful conclusion and return to the JCPOA. I agree with Israel that the deal will not be enough. But I am certain that Iran's nuclear threshold is still more dangerous. I can only note that Iran refuses to reach a successful deal.
So we'll have to see where all that goes. But it's going to be very interesting to see where it does go. So I guess that's the latest news that we have for you today. And we'll speak to you tomorrow on Thursday. And hopefully there'll be more news, that's for sure. Let me see. Wow, look at this. Djokovic staged an extraordinary comeback against an opponent by the name of Sinner, S-I-N-N-E-R, to reach the Wimbledon semis. That's going to be very interesting. Oh, this is really fascinating. Never thought I'd see anything like this. This is a, this is also interesting. Out of Mozambique, wiped out more than 40 years ago, rhinos have made a return to Mozambique. Listen in. One second. This should be very, very interesting. Yes, the rhinos were almost driven to extinction in the region, but they're roaming the wilds of Mozambique following an ambitious project to relocate the number of the animals from neighboring South Africa. Very interesting. All right, we'll find out soon enough when this thing gets started. 1 minute, this is loading up. So it may take a little bit of time. 1 minute here. More than four decades after they were driven to extinction in the region, rhinos are once again roaming the wilds of Mozambique and southern Africa. Wow. Their return is a result of a vast relocation operation that began in neighboring South Africa. So a group of rangers captured and sedated 19 white rhinos. And before loading them onto trucks for a journey more than 1,000 miles,
moving rhinos to a new safe range state, we are effectively spreading our eggs and putting them in different baskets. And by moving these rhinos to Zanav, it's the start of hopefully a couple of translocations of rhinos to that area that have been extinct for many years. And we hope that 10 years from now, there will be a thriving population of white rhinos in Zanav. They're important to the ecosystem, which is one of the reasons why we're moving them all this distance and doing all this effort to get them there.
The rhinos were then brought to their new home. Amazing. Mozambique's 400,000 hectares in Nav National Park. Wow. So wildlife numbers in Mozambique were badly hit by the country's 15-year civil war that ended in 1992. And the rhinos are just the latest animal to be reintroduced to the Nav, which is amazing. It's just reinstating the overall ecological system. Well, the Peace Parks Foundation is a conservation group overseeing the operation and aims to relocate more than 40 black and white rhinos to Mozambique in the next 2 years. That's exciting. Amazing, amazing. Just goes to show you what you can do. 40 years, annihilation, and then all of a sudden, somebody figured it out. Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. Okay. All right, so I think that we've got it all covered. It's just a few, about a minute or two before 11. So we'll speak to you tomorrow. And hopefully you'll be able to join us then. Let me move over to the studio screen and wish you a good day. Thank you and goodbye.